Hey, it's John. Did you know a quick finger prick at home can unlock over 180 insights to slow aging and boost health? I tried True Diagnostics True Age plus True Health Test, and it gave me way more information than a regular checkup. True Health checks biomarkers like vitamins, gut health, inflammation, and toxins. True Age reveals your biological age, organ ages, and aging pace with tailored tips to optimize. My results? My body shows signs of being a few months younger than my actual age. Fitness age is 5 years below my actual age, with a strong grip and gait, but a slightly fast aging pace that I'm trying to tweak with better sleep and stress management. It's backed by Ivy League scientists. Just prick, mail, and get a clear report in 2 to 4 weeks. Serious about longevity? Visit TrueDiagnostic.com. Use code Harris for 20% off your order or subscription. That's TrueDiagnostic.com, code H-A-R-R-I-S. Your future self will thank you. Welcome to part two of our conservative book series. I'm your host, John Harris. We are going to talk today about the Anti-Federalist Papers. Now, admittedly, the Anti-Federalist Papers are not a book like the last book we did, which was Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke. That was a book by an individual, and it's very easy to follow a book. This is a little more complicated. This is a series of essays, many of them showing up in newspapers, that were critical of the United States Constitution of 1787. The Federalists saw things that they thought would lead to potential tyranny, and they wrote about them, and many of their predictions, well, I'll let you be the judge, but they seem to have known something about where this was going to head. Now, the Federalists you might have heard of, because the Federalist Papers are often used to interpret the United States Constitution, as they should be. Conservatives, and not just conservatives, but people interested in understanding the federal constitution, will go back into the Federalist Papers to try to decipher what the original intent is of that document. But it's important to realize the Federalists were responding to another group. The group that shot first, the group that had issues before, were the Anti-Federalists. And one of the great contributions of the Anti-Federalists is demanding a Bill of Rights. You've probably heard the Bill of Rights quoted just as much as you have portions of the Constitution, if not more so. And the Bill of Rights is only in our Constitution really because of the pressure coming from Anti-Federalists. So they did make a positive contribution to what America is and what America became. They're also important to listen to because I frame them more as conservative critics. Not that many of the Federalists weren't also conservative and interested in conserving things that were true and beautiful and good and valuable, but the Anti-Federalists were suspicious of consolidated power. They thought the general government, and that's the term they used, would grow. The Supreme Court, the Congress, the presidency, all of these branches had too much power under the system that was proposed in 1787. And so one of their mechanisms for limiting that was the Bill of Rights. But even with that, many of them were still fairly suspicious and made predictions that honestly, we're pretty prescient, and I'll show you some of those. I think it's important in the 2020s to realize what these debates were back in the 1780s and 90s, because those debates honestly haven't left us. We are still debating some of the same things, pertaining to state and local authority versus the general government and consolidated power. We, if anything, have seen the growth of the national or the general government over the last few centuries. And as we're getting ready to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the United States, I think it's good to reflect on these things. Who were the conservatives? Was Alexander Hamilton one of the conservatives? Actually, he's one of the ones I think probably was the least conservative, if we understand conservative to be the securing and preserving of the decentralized Anglo-Protestant tradition that we've inherited. But he was one of the big Federalists. Was James Madison, was he a conservative? I think in many ways, yes. Russell Kirk thought he was. In some ways, though, well, he was also a friend of consolidated power, as was in some ways George Washington, who was influenced by Alexander Hamilton. One of the interesting things about this is it's not purely conservative liberal, but I think you could include both Federalists and Anti-Federalists in the conservative tradition, both of these documents. But if I were to choose which one was more conservative, which one was interested in preserving those local, unique structures that were inherited from Great Britain, I would say it's the Anti-Federalists. And this cuts across many lines. This isn't just a North-South thing. This is something that people in the South, people in the North, were on both sides of. And so this is at an early stage in the formation of the Federal Republic. It's a fascinating thing to hear them when they have no experience to draw on yet, except for the experience of being colonies and living under the Articles of Confederation and then studying the experiences of others in England and in Rome. It's interesting to hear them try to come up with ideas for what would be the best arrangement, which is what we still want today. We want the best arrangement, right, for our children. So it's with that in mind that I bring you the Anti-Federalist Papers. And most of this video is going to be available to patrons only. So I will remind you, if you want to see the full entire video, you're going to have to go to the info section and click on the link there. And you can either pay a very small fee to watch the whole thing, or you can become one of my monthly patrons, which I really appreciate. It helps me be able to do this kind of work, which I don't see being done in a lot of places. Much of this video also, though, is going to be free. So up until the point that we start talking about very specific differences between Federalists and Anti-Federalists, I am going for free to give you a background on the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. So let's start. Let's first talk about the Anti-Federalists. Let's talk about who they were. Here's a picture of some of the main Anti-Federalists. You have on the right side, Elbridge Gerry. He wrote Federal Farmer. He's from Massachusetts. You have George Clinton, governor of New York. He wrote the Cato Papers, we think. Now, some of this, by the way, is a bit speculative. We're not exactly sure who wrote Federal Farmer. Probably Elbridge Gerry, but we're not exactly sure. George Clinton, we're pretty sure, was Cato. We have Patrick Henry. He's the most prominent in this picture because he was probably one of the most prominent Anti-Federalists. We have Melancton Smith from New York. He wrote the Brutus Papers. And then we have Samuel Bryan, who wrote the Sentinel Papers. Now, you notice all these names are not, except for Patrick Henry, are there's two of them, right? You have names of people like Federal Farmer, right? You have pseudonyms. You have names that are not the name of the person behind them. In fact, in some cases, we don't know who is behind them. And maybe part of that is because the Anti-Federalists were the losers. Right. They didn't get everything they wanted. They got a Bill of Rights, but they still weren't able to stop the Constitution. And we know a lot more, I think, about the Federalists and who wrote them, because after the Constitution was adopted, there was no reason, essentially, to remain anonymous. But this forced people to be anonymous, forced people to deal with arguments and not just personalities. So I'm going to give you a little more details about who each of these were. But there you can see pictures. The only one that is not a historic representation, and I'm just going to admit this off the top because I could not find a historic representation, is Mr. Bryan over here, the author of Sentinel. I used a little bit of an AI picture generator to try to get a description of him and construct what he might have looked like. So other than him, these are all representations historically of what these particular men look like. Now, we have to understand the context in which these men are writing. The context is there are problems under the Articles of Confederation. I think it's important for every American to read the Articles of Confederation. If you read the Declaration of Independence, if you read the Constitution of the United States, and perhaps you read other things, maybe you read the Olive Branch Petition, maybe you read the Virginia Declaration of Rights, maybe you read some of the state constitutions or charters. Those are all good things. The Mayflower Compact, for example. But many people do not read the Articles of Confederation. And the Articles of Confederation were intended to be perpetual. I don't know if you knew that, but they were intended to go on and on and on, that to be an arrangement that would continue into the future. But the Articles of Confederation had some problems. Here's what James Madison said in 1787. There was an inability to regulate interstate commerce. He says, quote, "The practice of many states in restricting the commercial intercourse with other states, and putting their productions and manufactures on the same footing with those of foreign nations, though not contrary to the federal articles, is certainly adverse to the spirit of the Union and tends to beget retaliating regulations, not less expensive and vexatious in themselves than they are destructive of the general harmony. So you have all these states, 13 of them, and they have their different rules for regulating trade. And this creates confusion. They're changing. They seek their own interest. And you can't have smooth trade, especially if you want to trade from somewhere like New York, say, with Georgia. You got to go through all these other states, perhaps, or go into the ocean. And so how are you going to have smoothness in trade? Another issue here, Alexander Hamilton points out in Federalist 15, there's an inability to pay debts and settle disputes. He says, do we owe debts to foreigners and to our own citizens contracted in a time of imminent peril for the preservation of our political existence? These remain without any proper or satisfactory provision for their discharge. We have neither troops nor treasury nor government. So he's saying we have these debts. And after a war with Great Britain, of course, there were a lot of debts. And we have no ability to pay these back. We owe them on the state level. Some states are paying, some states aren't. There's one of the issues actually that they had a problem with is what do you do with all the claims that, for example, merchants in Great Britain have on companies and individuals and municipalities in the United States? Every state has different rules and different, and it's just very hard to pay debts, to settle disputes, to even have a credit system going forward with other countries when there's these 13 different states. And I think it's important to realize that they were 13 different states. I mean, there were 13, they were named separately in the treaty that Great Britain struck with the United States. They thought of themselves very differently. And at that time, it was the United States are, not the United States is. They weren't one consolidated group. It was 13 separate groups with their own unique royal charters, constitutions, and ways of doing things. The other issue was inability to solve bad credit and internal unrest. John Jay had written this to Thomas Jefferson in 1786. He said, the inefficiency of our government becomes daily more and more apparent. Our treasury and our credit are in a sad situation. And it is probable that either the wisdom or the passions of the people will produce changes. A spirit of licentiousness has infected Massachusetts, which appears more formidable than some at first apprehended. So John Jay is writing to Thomas Jefferson, and he's talking about unrest in the state of Massachusetts. And there is unrest over things like the inability to make good on pensions that Revolutionary War soldiers had. There was problems over the fact that when the states did try to tax in some areas, they were opposed for trying to tax. And so the general government could not force a taxation. They didn't have officers to do that. They relied on the states taxing and then giving a contribution, as it were, to the general government. But that system wasn't working. And that was also kind of a bad look for foreign governments. Why would you invest in a country like this? There was an inability to intimidate foreign powers. John Adams wrote to John Jay in 1785, it is the British fixed design to keep possession of the posts upon the frontier. So the British haven't even left the areas they were supposed to leave after the war for independence because the Americans have no ability. There's no force. There's no intimidation to stop them. They were just going to keep occupying forts that they had occupied for quite some time. Now, in this situation, there were essentially three options, says the Federal Farmer, one of the anti-federalists. And it would have appeared, if you're watching, in something like this. This is the Country Journal of Poughkeepsie, New York, which is right across the river from where I live. In fact, today there is a Poughkeepsie Journal. It tends to be more of a liberal outlet. I don't know if it traces back to this time, but this was the Poughkeepsie Country Journal. And Federal Farmer, his essays appear, his responses to the Constitution appear in this particular outlet. And he says there's three options. The Articles of Confederation aren't working. That's something everyone can agree on. And he says you could do this. You could have an arrangement where there's distinct republics connected under a federal head. So Congress can tax, make treaties, and wage war. So there's very limited powers Congress has. There's another arrangement you could have. You could have a consolidation, really, of all the states into one entire government. So forget about the states, right? Maybe they'll just be districts that are governed from the center. I would argue that this is what we have been heading towards for centuries. This is really what we ended up getting, but it took a long time, right, to get there. And different people will calculate this differently. Some will blame the Constitution. Others will say, no, it wasn't the Constitution. It was the Progressive Era. Or others will say it was Abraham Lincoln. It was these different forces. It was LBJ, right? It was these different forces that created the situation that we're in now. But either way, we ended up getting that situation. The Constitution doesn't seem to be able to have prevented that, right? That's the other option here, consolidation. And then the third option is consolidate the states as to certain national objects and leave them severely distinct independent republics. So the general government's powers extend to exclusively to foreign concerns and to a few internal concerns, to the coin, so that's to minting money, to post offices, to weights and measures, a general plan for the militia, and a naturalization, right? This is a federal system, essentially, right? There are two levels of government. You have state governments and you have a national or a consolidated government. So these are the three options here, right? And that he sees, at least, right? And the first one is more or less kind of what you had under the Articles of Confederation, maybe a little stronger. Congress can tax, right? The third one is perhaps even stronger, right? There's a greater consolidation. There's different shades of consolidation here, but it's still a federal republic. We're leaving the states alone, but we're gonna have post offices. We're gonna have coining. We're gonna have some certain things in common, right? It's a little more Alexander Hamilton, right? But I think what Hamilton really wanted, I think, was this third option, just a consolidation of the states into one entire government. And that's what we've been headed towards, but that's not how the Constitution was sold. And I would argue that's not even what the Constitution itself reflects. The Constitution was sold as and seems to reflect a federal division of some kind. And that is the American spirit, right? But the anti-federalists, who are really the federalists, saw a problem in how the Constitution would potentially be used. So let's talk a little bit about the Federalists first, okay? The Federalists wrote primarily under the name Publius. Publius, and this stands for Publius Valerius Publicola, a founder of the Roman Republic, who overthrew the monarchy in 509 BC, but yet he had an act of dismantling his hilltop house to dispel accusations of seeking kingship, which symbolized republican virtue and resistance to tyranny. So the Federalists are being accused of bringing in a consolidation. You know, it's a Caesarian type thing. This is power. This is control. This isn't good. And Publius, they're writing under that name to reinforce to people who would know something about Roman history, which they knew more of back then, at least educated people, that actually what they're trying to do is they want a republic. They don't want the monarchy. They want a smaller, more local and more, it's not what you think it is, right? And so they use this name on purpose. And there's three primary authors to the Publius papers, the Federalist papers. You have James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. And of course, Alexander Hamilton writes the most. He writes 51. James Madison writes 29, and John Jay only writes 5. And I think most of those are concerned with the judiciary. Now, James Madison was, he played a leading role. Many call him the father of the Constitution. And he helped introduce the Bill of Rights. Alexander Hamilton, from the first Secretary of the Treasury. But Alexander Hamilton, actually, funny enough, some people debate this even today, one of the non-Americans. Now, of course, you know, he's an American. I mean, at that time, many people were from other places because you had people born in Britain and so forth. But he was actually from the island of, I think it's pronounced Navies, in the British West Indies. And he was, he actually came there from there to the United States. So just an interesting tidbit there, but he was the first Secretary of the Treasury. He was a key advocate for a strong national government. Of course, James Madison being from Virginia. And John Jay, also being a Virginian, he's the first Chief Justice of the United States. He contributed essays to the Federalist Papers, only though five of them, and mostly on foreign affairs and the judiciary. These are your three main Federalists who are making the argument against the Anti-Federalists for the Constitution. Now, in Federalist 23 and Federalist 31, Alexander Hamilton says some, I think, very clear things that if you wanted to boil it down, what was their plan? What were they trying to do? It gives you a sense of it. So there were powers on the individual that the Constitution would have that were not available to the general government under the Articles of Confederation. And along these lines, Alexander Hamilton says, we must abandon the vain project of legislating upon the states in their collective capacities. We must extend the laws of the federal government to the individual citizen of America. So it's looking at this unit of the individual instead of the state, right? The general government before is looking at the states and governing an arrangement that the states are party to. Alexander Hamilton is saying there's a mechanism here for the government to actually look upon the individual itself. Now, this does not mean necessarily, this is not the Rosetta Stone on interpreting the Constitution, because of course the Constitution itself is something that is ratified by guess who? Not individuals, it's the states. So the states are actually party to this new Constitution, but Alexander Hamilton seems to have maybe some other motives in mind here. And he sees a potential for consolidating more power and getting some power over the individuals. He says the Union ought to be invested with the full power to levy troops, to build and equip fleets, and to raise the revenues which will be required for the formation and support of an army and a navy. And we'll later on talk about how this was a problem for the Anti-Federalists. They were very afraid of standing armies. The other thing was the power to incur debt. So Alexander Hamilton talks about this, and this is a big thing for him. He wants a national bank. He says the power of creating new funds upon new objects of taxation by its own authority would enable the national government to borrow as far as its necessities might require. So now the government can go into debt. The government can borrow on credit. This is something that was not possible before. Now it is. And it will be able to pay our debts if we are able to borrow from other people, right? From other interests. And this is, you can probably see if you're a conservative and you're hearing what I'm saying, and you're saying those are in the Federalist Papers. Oh my goodness. That doesn't sound very conservative. Well, there's a lot of things that don't sound, looking back, maybe that conservative, but you have to realize the times in which these documents were written. They're responding to the problems we already discussed regarding the Articles of Confederation. It's not the bloated government that we have today. Imagine if you didn't see anything regarding, you had no knowledge of the bloated government we have today, and you are trying yourself to create an arrangement along with other Americans that will prevent that kind of bloated government, right? So Alexander Hamilton later on, and we'll see some of these quotes, is saying, this isn't going to grow the government. It's not, you're not going to be taxed more because now we have a mechanism for taking taxes from the general government, where it's not going to do that. The things you're fearful of, it's not going to do that. All is well, right? So you can either take that on its face. You can. A lot of people have seen Hamilton to be a figure that was maybe lying and really wanted this strong central government. Two books off the top of my head on that. Brian McClanahan has one, How Alexander Hamilton Screwed Up America is the title of that book. There is another book by Tom Woods called Hamilton's Curse. And both of those scholars, they believe that Hamilton is, what the quotes I just read for you are really, that's what he wants. He wants this very big government. He likes debt. And he is bringing to us the world that we inhabit today. He's trying to bring that to us, but he knows he can't say everything that he's thinking. And he's got to assuage the fears of the Anti-Federalists. So this isn't a study on Alexander Hamilton, but Hamilton generally in more conservative and libertarian circles is kind of the bad guy in this whole story. And I would say this is also a personal thing for me. I see Patrick Henry as one of the good guys. I just happen to like Patrick Henry. In fact, I initially thought of doing a Patrick Henry side biography, but I would just recommend going and reading maybe a biography of Patrick Henry. There are several good ones out there. Here are the Anti-Federalists, okay? So here's a deeper dive into who they were. They wrote under a few different pseudonyms as well. So you have Sentinel, which is probably Samuel Bryan, the son of a Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice George Bryan. And Bryan warned that the Constitution favored elites and lacked a Bill of Rights, and he influenced Pennsylvania's ratification debates. His writings helped secure the adoption of the Bill of Rights. Then you have Melancton Smith, a delegate to the Continental Congress from New York, and possibly he may have written under the pen name Brutus. We're going to assume that's the case. It may have been Robert Yates. There's a few other people that are assumed or suspected of it. But Melancton Smith seems to have the best arguments for his authorship, and his speeches at New York's 1788 convention nearly blocked ratification, strengthening the push for amendments. And then we have my favorite. We have Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry opposed the Constitution at Virginia's 1788 convention. He argued it created a tyrannical government without a Bill of Rights, and his advocacy for amendments and states' rights was pivotal in securing the Bill of Rights. And one side thing I want to say about Patrick Henry, he's the guy who said, "Give me liberty, give me death," very famously. Patrick Henry is probably the most brilliant orator the United States has ever known. If not, he's up there. He's one of the top. And he had so much respect in his state of Virginia. Any office he ran for, he's going to win. He served in many capacities in the state of Virginia. He was a very conservative man. He was very intensely dedicated to the liberties of the people of Virginia. And one of the interesting things about him is towards the end of his life, George Washington essentially calls him up and says in his retirement, "I need you." And one of the crises that they're facing are the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. And actually, Patrick Henry lent his weight to the nationalists to some extent in that particular debate. But at his heart, he was someone who was a localist, a states' rights guy. He was, if anything, maybe, you know, I don't think Jefferson liked him too much, but he was like more Jeffersonian than Jefferson. And he is probably one of the best people that you can study in American history if you want to find a role model. One of the things also about him, I'll say, is towards the end of his life, especially, he became very concerned with advancing Christianity. And he handed out gospel tracts to people, gospel pamphlets, and talk to people about the Lord quite a bit. So he's a Christian hero in addition to being one of America's big heroes. But he, this American's American, opposed the Constitution of 1787. Isn't that interesting? And then, of course, we have George Clinton, the governor of New York. He wrote under the name Cato and criticized the Constitution's executive powers aristocratic. He led the New York's anti-federalists to demand amendments, and his efforts at the 1788 convention secured conditional ratification, bolstering the case for a Bill of Rights. Elbridge Gerry was a delegate from Massachusetts who likely wrote the Federal Farmer Papers and argued that the Constitution would violate states' rights. And you have here two of the Roman figures, Lucius Junius Brutus, who overthrew Rome's last king to establish the Republic, and then Cato the Younger, who died rather than live under Caesar's rule. So both of them known to be in the Roman history as those who supported a republic over consolidated power, which is what the Anti-Federalists wanted to be known as. Now, were the Federalists actually nationalists? This gets very confusing. They probably should be called the Nationalists because they saw the United States more as a national arrangement, that it was one consolidated thing. There were differences between states, but it was one thing. It was a nation. It was a national entity. And the Anti-Federalists were actually more of the Federalists. They viewed it as the more separations between these states. So James Madison says in Federalist 39, he says, "The proposed Constitution, therefore, is in strictness neither a national nor a federal constitution, but a composition of both." Well, that's interesting. "In its foundation, it is federal, not national. In the sources from which the ordinary powers of the government are drawn, it is partially federal and partially national." Now, that's partially because he's talking about the Senate and he's talking about the House and how they were different. There were differences in how one became a senator and one became a member of the House. But he's saying that it is partially federal, partially national. In the operation of these powers, it is national, not federal. In the extent of them, again, it is federal, not national. And finally, in the authoritative mode of introducing amendments, it is neither wholly federal nor wholly national. So make heads or tails of that, right? I mean, this is James Madison, father of the Constitution, and he's saying, our Constitution, it's not really national. It's not really federal. It's kind of both. But he leans more, by even admitting this, he is leaning more national than the anti-federalists, who are purely federal. They wanted the government to do some very limited things, the general government, but they wanted the states to retain most of the powers. Now, there were some points of agreement between the anti-federalists and the federalists. One of those points of agreement is in the picture here. It's George Washington. Both of them seemed to love, everyone loved George Washington, right? And you know, George Washington was a man of very high virtue, and this was something that both agreed on. In fact, this is something that Sentinel, which is probably Samuel Bryan, said in Sentinel 1. He said, a Republican or free government can only exist where the body of the people are virtuous and where property is pretty equally divided. In such a government, the people are the sovereign, and their sense of opinion is the criterion of every public measure. For when this ceases to be the case, the nature of the government is shaped, and in an aristocracy, monarchy, or despotism will rise on its ruin. So without virtue, he admits, you're going to get aristocracy, monarchy, or despotism. We need virtuous men if we're going to keep a federal republic. Without that, we're not going to have a federal republic. That's one of the issues that we have today. And we have James Madison in Federalist 10. He says the need for a self-limiting government. He says in framing the government, which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. These are two things, and there's more than this, but these are two main things that the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists would have agreed wholeheartedly on. We need public virtue. We need a self-limiting government. And we need George Washington. They both like George Washington. Now, one of the things that the Anti-Federalists felt that they were being forced into and they didn't like was adopting the Constitution too rashly. And this is warned about in John DeWitt 1, and we don't know who wrote the John DeWitt papers, and also in Brutus 2. In John DeWitt, it says, we are but yet in infancy, and we had better proceed slow than too fast. Has anyone ever told you that? Has anyone ever told you with a major decision, like maybe you're marrying someone, or you're choosing a school to go to, you're choosing a career path, hey, you better take this slow. You don't make this rashly, because this is going to affect the rest of your life, right? And that's just on a personal life. Well, what about the life of a nation? What about the life of 13 separate nations? What about the life of your family living in a governmental arrangement? What would you do in that case? Well, that's what John DeWitt is trying to get at. He's saying, I am as much a federal man as any person. In a federal union lies our political salvation, to preserve that union and to make it respectable to foreign optics. The national government ought to be armed with all necessary powers, but the subject I conceive of infinite delicacy and requires both ability and reflection. In discussing points of such moment, America has nothing to do with passions or hard words. Every citizen has an undoubted right to examine for himself. Neither ought he to be ill-treated and abused because he does not think at the same moment exactly as we do. So he's saying there's a room for diversity of opinions here. We don't want to make this decision too rashly. Yes, we might be in a situation that's not the best. And of course, a federal union is going to be our political salvation, but what does that union actually look like? Can we just pump the brakes? Melancton Smith, something similar.
Going online without ExpressVPN is like not having a case for your phone. Most of the time, you're probably fine, but all it takes is one slip, one hack, and you'll wish you spent a few bucks to protect yourself. Every time you hop on Wi-Fi at a cafe, hotel, or airport, your data's at risk. Hackers don't need to be geniuses, just some cheap gear, and even a kid could swipe your passwords, bank details, or credit card info. It's no wonder CNET and The Verge rate ExpressVPN the number one. I use ExpressVPN when I'm on public Wi-Fi, like when I'm traveling or grabbing coffee. Last month, I was at the airport, and knowing my data was safe gave me peace of mind to browse without worry. It's a must for me because I refuse to let hackers mess with my personal info. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/conversations. That's expressvpn.com/conversations to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months free. expressvpn.com/conversations.
And he brings a biblical example. He says, when the prophet Elisha told Hazael, I know the evil that thou wilt do unto the children of Israel. Their strongholds wilt thou set on fire, and their young men wilt thou slay with the sword, and wilt dash their children, rip up their women with child. Hazael had no idea that he ever should be guilty of such horrid cruelty, and said to the prophet, is thy servant a dog that he should do this great thing? And Elisha answered, the Lord hath showed me that thou shalt be king of Syria. The event proved that Hazael only wanted an opportunity to perpetrate these enormities without restraint, and he had a disposition to do them, though he himself knew it not. So what Melanchthon Smith is trying to say, using this vivid biblical imagery, is look, someone can seem innocent on the surface. Something like the Constitution and the people forwarding this Constitution, they may seem innocent on the surface. They want the right things, or their motives may be pure, but if you give them these powers, maybe they'll turn into something different. Maybe they're not going to be what they're like now, and it will be to our perdition. It will be to our peril. Our children will suffer with the consequences of what we do today, and therefore, it is better to take this slow. And that was one of the things that the anti-federalists were very animated about, of we need to be very careful with where we tread because there's a capacity for disaster. Now, opinions ranged on the extent to which the Constitution would be a problem to ordered liberty, federalism, local arrangements, etc. But there were some, John DeWitt, the second paper against the Constitution of 1787, he paints a very dystopian future. And I want to read some of this to you. He talks about central taxation, a standing army, the suspension of habeas corpus, the state courts being inferior to the federal judiciary. He talks about no trial by jury and the elimination of state constitutional power and the loss of state sovereignty. I'll read some of this to you. Central taxation, he says, you must also determine that they shall have the exclusive power of imposts and the duties on imports and exports, the power of laying excises and other duties, and the additional power of laying internal taxes upon your lands, your goods, your chattels, as well as your persons, at their sovereign pleasure, that the produce of these several funds shall be appropriated to the use of the United States and collected by their own officers, armed with a military force, if a civil aid should not prove sufficient. Now, to some of us, things like their own military officers, it doesn't seem like that big of a deal because we know the IRS is actually weaponized. And of course, they can have power and oversight over you if you don't pay your taxes and this kind of thing, right? Well, at this time, this would have been so foreign to the people he's writing to. They never would have known a situation where someone from the general government, someone from Washington, D.C., would be able to, with their own officers, come in and arrest you or have any kind of force over you to compel you to pay your taxes. This is not the world that they inhabit, but that's the world that's described here. And in that particular world, there's too much of the taxation going on. They can just do it at their sovereign pleasure. They just have to vote a bill in and you're taxed. And I don't know about you, but this is probably something that does hit close to home for many of you. Yeah, it does feel that way, doesn't it? I mean, do you feel overtaxed, right? That's really the question that he's trying to address here, is that's what will happen. He talks about a standing army in times of peace. This was one of the big issues that the anti-federalists had. They didn't want a standing army. And you think about some of the military actions that are more civil unrest situations arise. There was one recently in California. The National Guard is called up. At that time, they didn't have a National Guard. There was a development that took place, but they would have had civilians that were trained in military exercises. I mean, they just had a war, so they weren't short on those kinds of people. And they would get together for threats, commonly shared threats, right? But the idea of a standing army, the idea that you'd have professional soldiers on the payroll and of the federal government would have them on their payroll and they would do the bidding of the general government. The government could just call them up to go take care of business somewhere. That was something that frightened the anti-federalists. And it's something that now, being so downstream from this, we just live with that. Even the state militias, right? The National Guards are federalized with very little restrictions. There's a lot of ease in doing that. So, of course, that's one of the other issues that's brought up here. You have the state courts that will be inferior. And he says, you must also say that your present Supreme Judicial Court shall be an inferior court to a continental court, which is to be inferior to the Supreme Court of the United States. That from an undue bias which they are espoused to have, the citizens of their own states, they shall not be competent to determine title to your real estate. Disputes which may arise upon a protested bill of exchange, a simple note of hand, a book debt, wherein your citizens shall be unfortunately involved with the disputes of such or any other kind with citizens either of other states or foreign states. So he's saying if you have citizens of another state that have a claim on you, the dispute, you have one between yourselves or another country, that now you're going to have a court system set up with the Supreme Court being the highest level that will be able to decide those cases. You can appeal to the Supreme Court. The state courts will not have supremacy. This was a different situation than when they were used to. All they had only state courts. The state courts determined what would happen. If you had a problem with someone in domiciled in Virginia, you'd have to go to Virginia to deal with that and appeal to the courts of Virginia, right? Even if you lived in Pennsylvania. So this was another thing that they're concerned about. No trial by jury and the elimination of state constitutional power. He says in all such cases, they shall have a right to carry their causes to the Supreme Court, whether for delay only or vexation, however distant from the place you live or inconsistent with your circumstance. So basically, you could have to go to a court that's hundreds of miles away from where you live. At that time, that was a big deal. Today, we have planes, we have modern transportation. Back then, terribly inconvenient and terribly expensive. That such appeals shall be extended to matters of fact previously to a capacity of giving a complete answer to these proceedings. You must determine that the Constitution of your Commonwealth, which is instructive, beautiful, and consistent in practice, which has been justly admired in Europe as a model of perfection, and which the present convention have affected to imitate, a constitution which is especially calculated for your territory. So right now, I think what he's doing is he's talking about the, I believe he's talking about the articles and how he's saying that like there's our, either that or he's talking about a state constitution. I believe it's actually, it is the Constitution of Massachusetts because John DeWitt was written to the citizens of Massachusetts. So I'm pretty sure that's what he's talking about, not the articles. But anyway, he's saying, you have already a document that is admired, and this is one of the things that the present constitution, they're even taking this into consideration, this constitution of the state of Massachusetts. And that's not going to be the governing document, though, when you have a dispute with another state or another country. And then, of course, the loss of state sovereignty. John DeWitt says the skeleton of it may remain, but its vital principle shall be transferred to the new government. Nay, you must still go further and agree to invest the new Congress with powers which you have yet through proper to withhold from your own present government. So you're going to have powers that you've in Massachusetts have not given to your government, the state government. So now I'm sure he's talking about the Constitution of Massachusetts. And you are now going to give those powers, though, to an even more distant force. So these are the arguments or the future that he paints, John DeWitt. So this is what it's going to look like when you live under this thing. And some of those things we take for granted, but that would be something that for someone in 1787, 1788, 1789, that would have resonated, even in a place like Massachusetts. Now, one of the issues, one of the assumptions, one of the working assumptions between Federalists and Anti-Federalists, and I think there were likely Federalists who came down differently and Anti-Federalists who came down differently on this, but you could see emerging a fault line. There was a fault line forming between how one viewed the United States. And this, of course, I think was most prominently displayed in the American Civil War, in the war between the states, when you definitely had a contention that believed that it was the United States are in the South. And then in the North, the United States is. It's either preserve the Union, it's a one solidary thing, or this is, no, we the Confederacy is a federation of states, and we're all separate and distinct. And what you had in during the time that the Constitution was being debated is you had people more on the Federalist side of things who were arguing for consolidation. And you'd have people more on the Anti-Federalist side that were arguing for difference. So I'll give you some examples. John Jay says this in Federalist 2, and I've quoted this before. With equal pleasure, I have as often taken notice that Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people. Okay, so one united people he's talking about here. A people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, and who by their joint councils, arms, and efforts, fighting side by side throughout a long bloody war, have nobly established their general liberty and independence. Well, you have anti-federalist John DeWitt here, who, again, that's a pseudonym. We don't know exactly who wrote this, but someone who's writing to Massachusetts. And John DeWitt says, from the first settlement of the country, the necessity of the civil associations founded upon equality, consent, and proportionate justice have ever been universally acknowledged. The means of education always attended to, and the fountains of science brought within the reach of poverty. Hitherto, we have commenced society and advanced in all our respects, resembling a family, without partial affections or even a domestic bickering. So there is some unity here, but it's a family unity. We're not one people in a sense. We are, there's different, there's sons, there's daughters, there's aunts and uncles, and we have a connection to each other, but we do have differences. He follows it up in his second paper, John DeWitt II, the difference of interest, different manners, and different local prejudices in the different parts of the United States that to obtain that majority of 3/4 to any of the single alteration. Now, what he's talking about here is amending the Constitution. So he's saying, if you want to amend this Constitution, it's going to be hard because look at the differences between us. We have to find 3/4 of us who agree. He says, essentially, affecting this or any other state amounts to an absolute impossibility. Why is it impossible, John DeWitt? Because we're so different, he says. The conduct of the delegates in dissolving the convention plainly speaks this language and no other. So you have the anti-federalists saying, you know what? We got differences. That's what they're emphasizing. We've got differences. Massachusetts is not Virginia. Yeah, we're like a family. There's similarities, but there's differences. And John Jay emphasizing, look, we're actually one people. And I think that is a fault line that is still in our country. That is still a debate that's happening, whether or not we should be governed by one size fits all government emanating from Washington, D.C., over all the various municipalities and jurisdictions of this grand country, from Alaska to Hawaii to California to New York to Florida and everything in between, or whether we are, in fact, different, and maybe different decisions should be made in different places. We still have issues that come up, and there's still friction on whether this is a national issue or whether this is a state issue. Back then, people would have thought of themselves, even their identity, as coming from the state that they lived in. That was their country. I mean, remember when Robert E. Lee even said he cannot raise his arm against his own country. Virginia was his country, right? And that's how people thought. Now, when you say my country, you think of the whole United States of America. Alaska's part of it. Hawaii's part of it. I don't mean to pick on them, except that they're just in distance. They're just farther away. So, but even there, even the people there and the cultures there, which are very different, they're part of this, right? But there was a time in this country's history when you could be talking about your country and you meant the state that you were from. You were a Virginian. You were a Carolinian. That kind of thing. So for the Federalists, the source of threat, much of the source of threat was local. Okay. Now, the Federalists believe that there was foreign threats and we needed to consolidate to try to stave off foreign threats to be strong in the face of other countries. But they thought that the weakness in our national fabric would come from the fact that there's these states with very different interests and different localities and regions, and that these regions themselves would contribute to a weak national government. And so what we needed to do was consolidate them. So the Federalists very much suspected a threat in the local. Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 1 says, among the most formidable of the obstacles which the new Constitution will have to encounter may readily be distinguished the obvious interest of a certain class of men in every state to resist all changes which may hazard a diminution. Am I saying that? Yeah, diminution of the power, emolument, and consequence of the offices they hold under the state establishment. So what he's saying is that there's this hierarchy, there's this landed gentry, there's a class of people that are on the state level that are nobility, essentially. They have power. And he's saying those guys have ambition. They have perverted ambition. And The perverted ambition of another class of men who will either hope to aggrandize themselves by the confusions of their country or will flatter themselves with their fair prospects of elevation from the subdivision of the empire into several partial confederacies than from its union under one government. So Alexander Hamilton is saying, hey, one of the things that could happen here, one of the proposals is that we just have different confederacies. We split up, right? Well, if that happens and we're just regions, I mean, look, what's going to happen? These local leaders are going to be leading things, right? Now, what makes them think national leaders are going to be any better? Well, we'll see. Alexander Hamilton also says in Federalist One, a dangerous ambition more often lurks behind the specious mask of zeal for the rights of the people than under the forbidding appearance of zeal for the firmness and efficiency of the government. Now, he may be talking about Patrick Henry there. Patrick Henry was very much about the rights of the people and very connected to the nobility of Virginia. I mean, he could have power if he wanted it, whenever he wanted it. And he had virtue. And Alexander Hamilton is looking at that. And he's saying, well, that's more of a threat because what happens is we're not going to get the firmness and efficiency of government with people like that around. James Madison, Federalist 10. Among the numerous advantages promised by a well-constructed union, none deserves to be more accurately developed than its tendency to break and control the violence of faction. So the violence of faction of the small unit, of the regional, the local hero and his connection with the people in a local region, that is the threat to connecting with each other and forming a efficient government, which is what Alexander Hamilton wanted. It's the control of the violence of the faction. So the faction ends up being the problem here. And of course, the particular picture I have here is Shays' Rebellion. Shays' Rebellion shows, look, you can have factions. You can't have local leaders that have problems and cause issues on a local level. So of course, you know, let's give them the benefit of the doubt here. This kind of thing does happen. But I'll ask you a question. Where do you more often see the great threats to your freedom and liberty? Is it from your local government? Could be. Is it from the national government? The Anti-Federalists thought the source of the threat would be consolidation more than the local. So Patrick Henry says at the Virginia Ratification Convention, he stands up, and this is, of course, a picture of him in give me liberty or give me death speech. So this is a younger Patrick Henry. But when it came to the Virginia Ratification Convention, he said, we drew the spirit of liberty from our British ancestors. By that spirit, we have triumphed over every difficulty. But now, sir, the American spirit, assisted by the ropes and chains of consolidation, is about to convert this country into a powerful and mighty empire. If you make the citizens of this country agree to become the subjects of one great consolidated empire of America, notice he uses the word empire here, your government will not have sufficient energy to keep them together. Such a government is incapable with the genius of republicanism. There will be no checks, no real balances in the government. So he's saying, you can say bye to your liberty. This is going to be an empire. You think you're getting a federal republic, you're going to get an empire if you go through with this. Now, of course, it's important to remember when I'm talking about this, we are talking about a constitution without a Bill of Rights at this point, okay? Of course, the Bill of Rights are added, and that addition assuages enough of the Anti-Federalists that they go along with it, right? But this is what Patrick Henry fears. Sentinel, which was written probably by Samuel Bryan, he says, it is the opinion of the greatest writers that a very extensive country cannot be governed on democratical principles. So there's a scale issue here. You have such a big country. How are you going to have a democracy? How do you even, there's no mechanism for everyone to have their say. So you have a Republican form, but then the more people, the more regional distance, the less proximity there is from the representatives to the people they represent, and the more people they represent, which means less access to the person who represents you. You can't have a democratic system like this. Federal Farmer says one government and general legislation alone never can extend equal benefits to all parts of the United States. Different laws, customs, and opinions exist in the different states, which by a uniform system of laws would be unreasonably invaded. So he's saying we got to keep our local customs, our local differences. They're suited to our regions. We can't just let a one-size-fits-all government come in. That's going to be the threat to our liberties. Now, which has been more of a threat to liberties in the long run? Has it been the local Has it been states? States can certainly do that. Local governments can certainly do that. But has it been the national government? Because when the national government makes the decision, it's for everyone, right? The general government is jurisdiction flows in, over the entire span of the United States of America. So this is one of the things, the Federalists and Anti-Federalists, they're hashing this out back then. We're still hashing some of this out. Now, the Federalists needed to sell this to the states. They needed to convince states who are hearing these Anti-Federalist arguments that there's no merit to them, that these fears are overplayed. Don't worry about it, right? So John Jay says in Federalist 2, now he tries to talk about the fact that there's one people, and he uses this language to appeal to them, that an inheritance so proper and convenient for a band of brethren, united to each other by the strongest tie, should never be split into a number of unsocial, jealous, and alien sovereignties. So there's an emotional appeal here. Like, look what we went through together. We went through the Revolutionary War together. We've been through so much. Why don't we got to stay together. I mean, this is, it echoes kind of, you could hear the, like the preserve the union language that came during the Civil War, right? We got to stick together, guys. Tradition, also another appeal they make. But politicians now appear, says John Jay, to insist that this opinion is erroneous, that instead of looking for safety and happiness in union, we ought to seek it in a division of the states and distinct confederacies or sovereignties. So, well, you know, he's saying we've been together. We fought a war together. I mean, that's just the default, right? We've been together. And look, there's people out there who want separate united republics. They want separate confederacies. We shouldn't. And there were people saying things like this. Now, whether they were serious, I mean, this is what he's trying to say, though, that tradition is on our side, right? Now, whether it was or not, I mean, it's is tradition on their side when it comes to a stronger federal government? Perhaps not, but tradition is on their side in that they've suffered through things together. They have shared experiences together, the various states. Now, popularity is another thing. Now, this is popular, guys. Get on the bandwagon. Federalist 3, John Jay says that consideration naturally tends to create great respect for the high opinion which the people of America have so long and uniformly entertained of the importance of their continuing firmly united under one federal government, vested with sufficient powers for all the general and national purposes. In other words, this is popular. People want this. You know, the people of America, this is what they want, right? So anytime you think something's popular, you're more inclined to it, unless you're a hipster. And then if it's popular, you don't like it anymore, right? Talent is another thing. Look, John Jay says this, and this is, I told you earlier, I signaled this. I said, you know, what are the leaders going to look like if they're not the local leaders that you're attached to? Well, this is what the leaders would look like, right? It will be the widest field of choice, says John Jay. So you, the people that you're going to have ruling you are going to be the best of the best. Why? Because it's not just the best in Virginia. It's not just the best in North Carolina or Delaware. You're going to have the whole span of the country to choose from, right? You're going to get the best people, right? Trump says he has the best people. You're going to have the best people from all these various places. And the theory back then was that in a virtuous republic, the most people with the most virtue would rise to the top. This was the natural aristocracy Thomas Jefferson talked about. The people with virtue are naturally going to be the leaders of the local area. And then when they have elections and competitions and, you know, the best man wins and eventually you get the best kind of leader. And George Washington, look, he's the best. So wouldn't that, in that time, it might seem like that, right? So I don't, now looking back at this over 250 years later, what do we actually think about this, right? What do we actually think? Or actually, I said over 250 years. It's not quite, because this was 1787, they were debating all this. But, you know, what kind of leaders populate our Senate? What kind of leaders populate the House of Representatives or the administration in presidencies? Are they the same quality as the leaders that you would get at a local or state level? That's a question I think worth asking. Oftentimes, it seems like you get worse people in the higher offices because of various things like they're having a selfish ambition and ladder climbing and dirt on other people and being able to have money to buy the office. And I mean, all these other factors, right? And maybe that's because we don't have the same virtue anymore. But that was the theory that John Jay thought. We're going to get the best leaders. We're also going to have a limited central government, guys. It's not going to be like the Anti-Federalists tell you, okay? It's not going to be that consolidated. Federalist 23. So it's going to be for a mutual benefit. The principal purposes to be answered by union are these: the common defense of the members, the preservation of the public peace as well against internal convulsions or external attacks, the regulation of our commerce with other nations and between states, and the superintendence of our intercourse, political and commercial, with foreign countries. Alexander Hamilton says this. What's he saying? It's just trade. It's the stopping attacks that could come. That it's limited to those things. It's not, we're not going beyond that. We're going to regulate commerce. It's going to be better, more efficient. We're going to have a better military. Like, but we're, that's it, guys, right? So don't go thinking that we're going to have all the various federal bureaucracies we have today. We're not going to have an EPA. We're not going to have, a Department of Education. We're not going to have all the various intelligence agencies and education agencies. And none of that would have, they would have been shocked. I think even Alexander Hamilton would probably be shocked at what we have today. Possibly. It's going to have states' rights, guys. We're not getting rid of that. James Madison, Federalist 45, the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. So it's going to be a limited government. States are still going to have rights. Don't worry about it. Right? That's what they're trying to say to sell it to the states. They're also saying it's for our safety. Federalist 3, among the many objects to which a wise and free people find it necessary to direct their attention, that of providing for their safety. Peace. We're going to have peace. An entire and perfect union will be the solid foundation of lasting peace. Federalist 5, peace from faction, right? If these states should be either wholly disunited or only united in partial confederacies, the subdivisions into which they might be thrown would have frequent and violent contests with each other. That's Federalist 6. So look, the theory here is like, if we don't unite under one government, the states are just going to go to war. Like they're not going to like each other. Right. This is an interesting thing because you can see in other places that, throughout Europe, for example, for centuries, you would have intermarriages among the elites to try to prevent war. Right. If you're married to the Queen of France, maybe you're not going to go to war. Right. That kind of thing. But there have been many times European powers come together to meet a threat. Think of the Cold War, right? Western Europe unites. There are situations where sovereign countries unite, actually quite often, because of a threat that is against all of them. So the theory here, though, is that if they don't unite under a central government that, Virginia and Pennsylvania, Maryland, they're not going to like each other too much. And there's going to be friction between them. Foreign nations was the other threat to peace, whether the division of America into any given number of independent sovereignties would tend to secure us against the hostilities and improper interference of foreign nations. So what if England has an alliance with Virginia and wants to invade Georgia, right? Virginia is not helping Georgia in that circumstance, right? So wouldn't it be better if we were all together, right? And there's some logic to this. From becoming enemies, neighboring nations, says Federalist 6, are naturally enemies of each other. I don't know that that's true. They're naturally enemies. In fact, are we naturally enemies of Canada? I don't know about that. There's some animosity there. But I think more often than not, we have to get along with the people that we're next to. And aren't you glad that we're not united with Canada? By the way, tidbit here. Canada, under the Articles of Confederation, could have become one of the states in the United States anytime they wanted to. I don't know if you knew that. But Canada was actually potentially going to be a state in the United States at one time. Now, aren't you glad in a way that that didn't happen? Because look at Canada today. And if the people, it would just add to the dominance that the Northeast has. And that's why at the Hartford Convention, the Northeast thought about joining Canada, right? We have much in common with Canada. We could join them and get rid of all these Southerners, these agrarian people that have a different interest, these war hawks. We're a trade people, a seafaring people. We'll just join Canada. So that's a free one there. But Canada obviously has been somewhat of an ally of the United States. So I don't know that this is completely true, but that was the theory. And efficiency is the next thing, right? So safety, peace, efficiency. We're going to have a more efficient government if we consolidate. Federalist 4, how and when and in what proportion shall aids of men and money be afforded? Who shall command the allied armies and from which of them shall receive his orders? Who shall settle the terms of peace? And it goes on and on with like all these questions about Where's the chain of command, right? That's the central question this is getting at. How do you know whose orders to follow if you have the generals of all these different places, right? Wouldn't it be better if we had one military and it's more efficient, right? So that's the argument. Those are the arguments that they give to the states. Now, at this point, let me just see. Yep. Okay. At this point, we're going to cut it off. It's been a little over an hour. And I've described to you what the Federalists thought, what the Anti-Federalists thought, but I haven't gotten into specific clauses in the Constitution, which is what we're going to do next with the second half of this particular podcast. This will only be for patrons, though. So if you want to see the second half, go to the link in the info section for this video, and you will be able to purchase for a very small price the second half, or you can just become one of my monthly patrons. If you don't have the money, you don't want to, just message me on any of the social media platforms. I'll hook you up with the link, right? But if you are a patron, you will also have access to this slideshow, and you can use it however you would like. I put no restrictions. There's no copyright on it. I made it for you. You can, if you're a teacher, I know there's some teachers out there who have used some of my slides for things. You can use it however you want. Edit it, insert new pictures, new things. But we're going to now discuss the differences that Federalists and Anti-Federalists have over specific provisions in the Constitution. And then we're going to go through some predictions. I'm going to show you the predictions the Federalists made about what would happen if the Constitution was passed. I'm also going to show you the predictions that Anti-Federalists made if the Constitution were to pass, which it did. And then finally, at the end, I'm going to show you some of the foreshadowing that we see in these debates for what happened later, namely the Civil War. And then ask the question at the end, what makes a true American? What makes a true American? Patrick Henry had a thought on that he shared in his speech against the federal Constitution. So that's where we're heading with the rest of the video. For those who are not able to watch the rest of it or don't have any interest, thank you for watching this video. We have many more books to cover in our Anglo-American conservative book series that we're doing, and I look forward to getting to them. The next one will likely be John C. Calhoun's Disquisition on Government, so you can look forward to that. God bless.
Everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit DiscoverSouthCarolina.com.